getting into dilation theory. Well, we saw a dilation theorem at the end of last time, Steinspring's dilation theorem. We're going to go back to the past a bit more first today, and then we'll tie it in with that. So first of all, let's start with a single operator. So if T is in B of H, and then you say that an operator A in B of K, where K is a bigger Hilbert space that contains A as a subspace, is a dilation. Historically, it was called power dilation, but the word power dilation is basically not used anymore. It's just a dilation. So you might see some literature that says power dilation of T. If you have, if you take a power of A, restrict it to H, that'll map H into K. You project back down onto H. Then that should be equal to T to the N for all N greater or equal to 0. Okay. In particular, if T is less than or equal to 1, then a unitary dilation of T is a dilation which is unitary. Okay. All right. Now, this power dilation property means that not only is the compression of every power of A to H equal to that same power of T, but by taking linear combinations, any polynomial in A compresses to a polynomial in T. So in fact, we have a map that takes this algebra of polynomials in A to the map of polynomials in A. So I'm going to talk then about generally. Suppose I have A is an algebra of operators. Now for us, let's keep the identity in it. It's not really necessary, but so this is an algebra of operators. Let's say A is contained in B, a C-star algebra. Okay, and suppose I have a representation, rho, from A to B of H. In other words, homomorphism. And it's going to, in other words, right, then we say that a B dilation of rho is a star representation sigma from B to some Hilbert space K, where K contains H. Such that if you take A and A, and you take sigma of A, restricted to H, compressed back down to H, that should be equal to rho of A. Okay. Now, to see the connection between these two, let me give you a little proposition, which is that Well, let me set the stage first. Okay, so like I said, so we're going to take, if I'm going to take P norm less than or equal to 1, and we can take A of T to be the set of all polynomials in P, closed up in the norm. Okay. And, well, let's not even close it up. All right, let's not even close it up. All right. And if you can dilate T, if U is unitary dilation, okay, then I claim that you get, this gives rise to a C of T dilation of this map rho of a polynomial is equal to P of T. And the reason that this is true is this, is that suppose if you have a unitary dilation, then you get a representation of C of T, all right? You get a star representation sigma from C of T into B of K by sigma of F is equal to F of U. Okay, so in particular, if I take sigma of the function z to the n, okay, and I restrict it to h and project onto h, well, that's projection onto h of u to the n, which is t to the n. Okay, so in other words, the functional calculus is just functional calculus. This star dilation here of this representation gives rise to the unit, the essence of the unitary gives rise to this star dilation. And conversely, if you have a star representation of C of T, then you go back by this way. So you have a bijective correspondence here. Okay. So these two relations are closely related. Now there's a theorem due to Saracen that explains in a structural way how you get dilations in a certain, well, at least what dilations look like. And it says the following. Suppose we have A is an algebra, operators, operator algebra. Okay. And row mapping A to B of H is a representation. Okay. And sigma mapping A to B of K is a dilation of sigma. I don't need a C-star algebra, but just, in other words, projection onto H of sigma of A restricted to H is equal to rho of A. Then there exist two subspaces. M2 contained in M1 contained in K subspaces. And they are invariant for sigma of A, in other words, sigma of A, MI is contained in MI, okay, for all A and A, such that H is equal to M1 minus M2. Okay. So let me interpret that, what that means. You take your Hilbert space K, And here you have M2 is the smallest Hilbert space, that's M2. H is orthogonal to that. The direct sum is M1. And so what's left is M1 perp. Okay? So, the fact that they're invariant means that you have a upper triangular form. Sigma of A looks like, and I can write it as a 3 by 3 matrix with respect to this decomposition. So here you have M2, here you have H, here you have M1 perp. And the fact that M1 is invariant means that sigma of A has sigma 1, 1 of A there, and these are zeros because it maps M1 into M1. Okay. M2 into M2. M1 is mapped into itself, so that means that these first two things are mapped into itself. So that means that you have here sigma 1, 2 of A, and here you have the compression rho of A, because it's a dilation, and here you have a zero. And here you have stuff, too. I could give them names, but it's not so important. All right. So, in fact, we can forget about the symbols for this. Point is that we have a 3 by 3 upper triangular form with the 2, 2 entry being rho of A. Now, it's clear that if you have a representation sigma of A that looks like this, then when I compress to that Hilbert space H, I get rho. And the point is that compression is multiplicative. So the way we prove this theorem is by basically using the fact that compression is multiplicative to show that it has this form. Okay. All right. So to prove that, M1, we'll let M1 be the smallest invariant subspace containing H. So it's going to be the span of the set of all rho of A H such that A belongs to A and H belongs to H. So this is the smallest sigma of A, not rho of A, excuse me, sigma of A. Smallest sigma of A invariant subspace, which contains H. Okay, so it is clear that that closed subspace is invariant, and that it contains H, and that you have to, if you had such a thing, you would have to contain all of those guys. All right? So let's let M2 be M1 minus H. Yeah, it's close. Sorry. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, otherwise you wouldn't know that it contained H. It could be the zero algebra. That wouldn't be any good. However, if you had such an operator algebra, you could always throw in the identity, define rho on the identity to be the identity, and that would extend the representation. Okay, so you don't really need a unital algebra, but you just throw it in. Those are equivalent. This just says that M1 is equal to the orthogonal direct sum of H and M2, and that says the same thing. That's a direct minus. Yeah, it means it's the orthogonal complement inside. This means it's the orthogonal complement of H inside M1. Right. This is true, and what we really need to check is the invariance of M2. Okay, that's the only thing that needs to be checked. Okay. So this fact that it's a representation, we have if A and B are in A, all right, 0 is equal to rho of AB minus rho of A, rho of B. Okay. And then the fact that sigma is a dilation of that means that this is the projection onto H of sigma of AB. Let me save a step here by writing sigma of AB as sigma of A, sigma of B, restricted to H, minus projection onto H, sigma of A. And I have to be strict to H here, so let me put a projection onto H, sigma of B, restricted to H. So you see the difference in these two is that in the product rho of A, rho of B is the product of two compressions. I end up with this extra projection in here. So this is equal to P of H, sigma of A, PH perp, sigma of B, restricted to H. I have a little space here. Now, what's the range of all of those things? All right? If I take the range of sigma BH and let B run over all B's in the algebra A, I get a dense subset of this subspace M1. Okay. So they span M1. So I can put an M1 here. Okay. And since this spans all of M1, this implies that pH sigma of A P of M1 orthogonal minus H equals 0. All right? This operator acts on all of these vectors, but these vectors are dense in all of M1, and so therefore this has to be 0. Okay? Wherever non-zero, there'd be some, you'd get close to some vector on which it was non-zero. So what does that say? That's projection onto M2. Okay? And so we have sigma of A projection onto M2, well, is certainly equal to projection into M1 sigma of A projection onto M2, because M2 is contained in M1 and M1 is invariant. But it's also perpendicular to H, so I can put a PH perp here. Right? This is from the invariance of M1, and this is from the square over there. And so that's projection onto M2. And that's just an algebraic way of saying that M2 is invariant. On to proof. Okay. All right.
About definition, I mean, I think just this rather means the dilation of polynomial. It's not the algebra.
Yeah. Well, we'll.
Nothing to do with.
Oh yeah. Well, we'll tighten that up.
Yeah.
In a little bit. All right. So. Theorem due to Nash. Says that every contraction has a unique minimal unitary dilation. So if you have T and B of H, T less or equal to 1, obviously, if it has a dilation to a unitary, it can't, its norm can't be any bigger than the norm of a unitary, and a unitary has norm 1. So that's the very minimal thing we need. Then T has a unitary dilation. Okay. In fact, there is a unique minimal unitary dilation. All right. So the first one, we already saw what the first one meant. It just means there's this unitary on this bigger space. All right, so what does it mean? So by Sanderson's theorem, the unitary dilation is a unitary U on K, which I can write as H plus direct sum H direct sum H minus, such that U has a 3x3 matrix form, which has this upper triangular structure and has a T in the middle entry. Okay, as soon as it has an upper triangular form like this, it's obvious that if I take powers of U, then on the diagonal entries I just get powers. So in particular in the 2-2 entry I get powers of T. Okay. Now what does minimal mean? Minimal means that you don't have any extra stuff. I mean, it's clear that if I have a unitary dilation U, then if I take U direct sum V, where V is any other unitary, that's also a unitary dilation. But that V is extraneous. So to get rid of that, we say that K should be the smallest U and U star invariant subspace containing K. So this should be the span of U to the KH. K goes from minus infinity to plus infinity. All right. It has to be invariant for U star as well, because otherwise the restriction of U to that subspace may not be a unitary. It would only be an isometry unless it was also invariant for U star. So we take the smallest. So what if I have one unitary dilation, I can clearly get a minimal one. By just taking this span of all these subspaces, and the restriction there is a unitary, and it dilates it. And uniqueness I think you can obviously see that once I get some dilation, I could change things, say, by multiplying the right hand column by minus 1. That would still be a unitary. And it would look a little different. So what do I mean unique? Unique means that if, suppose I have U1 on K1 and U2 on K2, both minimal unitary dilations, this means that there exists a unitary W mapping K1 to K2, such that two things happen. One is that W restricted to H should be the identity on H. Okay, we don't want to move things on H. Okay, and two, they should intertwine the two things. So in other words, WU1 should equal U2W. Okay, so this says that not only are these two unitary dilations unitarily equivalent, but this unitary equivalence fixes H so that we're not changing T at the same time. Okay. All right, I'll give you two proofs, but I guess as from something which Troy was saying, I mean the second proof relies on something that we get out of the first proof. although it's possible to prove it independently. All right, but this will be proof number one. All right, so how do you dilate an operator T if norm less than 1? Well, in particular, if you take a unitary and restrict it to a subspace, it has to be an isometry, all right? So this column here has to be an isometry, all right? And T being a contraction, it goes a certain way towards preserving norm, but it's a little too small. We have to throw something in to make it the norm right, and there's only one thing you can do it up to multiplying it by some isometry afterwards, and that's to use this so-called defect operator, I minus T star T, the 1/2. Okay. Because that has this property that if I take let's put dt and t here, I claim that that's an isometry, because if I compute the adjoint of that times dtt, what you get is dt squared plus t star t is the identity. Okay, so in other words, I chose this just exactly to be the positive operator whose square was 1 minus t star t, so this added up to the identity. So that's an isometry. Okay. And in fact, you could check that if you wanted the same, that second row should be a co-isometry, you could put dt star there, and it'll have that has the same effect. And if you put a minus t star here, and you multiply everything out, you can check that this is a unitary. Okay. It's a calculation worth doing, but I'll leave it for you to work out. Now, this unitary isn't any good because it doesn't have any power dilation properties. I could have flipped it around and had T in the 1-1 entry, but it still wouldn't have been a dilation because when I start taking powers, things screw up. But the trick is to put it here, basically. All right. So consider U to be the following. It's a big matrix. It's going to act on the direct sum of commonly many copies of my Hilbert space. All right, so I'm going to have one copy of my Hilbert space here, and then another one, and then another one, and then another one. Okay, so in other words, H infinity here is this direct sum . So this is the set of all vectors of the form direct sum of hk, such that the hk's belong into h, and the sum of the squares to the 1/2, that should be finite, and that's the norm. Okay, so that's a Hilbert space with just a whole bunch of Hilbert space subspaces there, which all look like the same one. And I'm going to put T here. And then I'm going to take that little unitary, dt, dt star, minus T star. And now what's happening? This acts on, suppose I call this H0, H1, H2, H3, H-1, H-2, etc. It's taking these two subspaces, H0 and H-1, and mapping it onto these two, right? Because that little 2x2 matrix is a unitary. When I put it off center like this, it's taking this subspace isometrically onto this subspace. But now, where do I send H1? H1, we've already mapped onto H1. We have to map it to something perpendicular to it, so I'm going to stick an identity up there. I'm just going to shift everything up. And H0 directs from H-1 is mapped onto H1 directs from H0. I have to map something onto H-1. That something is H-2. And everything else is zeros. So there you have it. And it has this upper triangular form that I wanted. So it's a 3x3 upper triangular form with a T as a 2-2 entry. So it is a unitary dilation of T. Okay. It's not minimal, generally. Sometimes it's minimal, but sometimes it's not. Okay. So to get a minimal one, we let K exactly be that subspace, the span of U to the KH. Now, yeah, right. K running over all the integers. Okay. And U1 is U restricted to K is a minimal unitary dilation. Okay. So uniqueness is supposed to let U2 be another minimal unitary dilation on, say, K2. Well, what's a typical vector here in K? That's a typical. Is a sum of U to the K, HK, some finite sum, a finite subset of the integers. So the HKs have to belong to H, and the Ks have to be integers. But I'm just looking at a finite sum. What I want to do, how I want to define W, is I want to send, U1. I want to be able to send the vector which has a U1 here to the corresponding vector that has U2s. And if I can do that, I'll be okay. So I have to check that that's well defined, which means I have to check that that map is in fact isometric. And that'll do it. So we have to compute the inner product of two vectors that look like that. So I have this some finite sum, U under the K, HK, and let me take an inner product of that with U1 to the L, H prime sub L. So H primes are some different vectors. Okay. So that's a double sum over your K's and your L's of the inner product U under the K, HK, U1 to the L, H primed L. And of course, being unitary, I can carry it the U1 over the other side. It becomes a U1 star and it cancels. And I only want to write this using positive powers of U. So I'm going to, when k is bigger or equal to L, I'm going to move everything to the left. And when k is less than L, I'm going to move everything to the right. So this becomes a sum over k greater or equal to L of u1 to the k minus L hk h primed L plus the sum over k less than L of hk u to the L minus k h prime L. So the advantage of that is that now this belongs to h and this belongs to h. So I have in here, I can put a little projection onto h here and here, which of course comes over and puts a little projection here. Same thing here. I've got a projection here, and I've got a projection here, which moves over and gives me a little projection onto h there. But when you compress u1 to h, the fact that it's a power dilation of t means that you can replace those with t's. Replacing those u's with t's, I now have an expression that doesn't depend on it being u1 that I started with. It only depends on the fact that it was a minimal unitary dilation. If I'd have started with u2 instead of u1, the calculation would have gone exactly the same way, and I've got the same answer. So here I can write u2 to the k hk inner product u2 to the l h prime l. Okay. So now we can define W mapping K1 over to K2 by W of this sum U1 to the K HK equals the summation of U2 to the K HK. All right? And this argument shows that this map is isometric. And in particular, well defined. Right? Because if you had two expressions that gave you the same vector, their difference would be the zero vector. It would have zero norm. So it would have to be sent to something with zero norm. In other words, it's well defined. It's isometric. It's densely defined because the set of those vectors is dense and a dense range. So it extends by continuity to a unitary. And then it's clear that, particularly that W of H is that W of U to the 0 H, U1 is U2 to the 0 H is H, okay? So in other words, W is the identity on H, and W U1 H is U is U2 H, which is U2 WH. And then from that, we could do any powers here. And this gives you that WU1 is equal to U2W. Because now you apply this to any of those vectors, okay? So, that's Nod's theorem. It has some, yes? Well, yeah, they could be vacuous, for instance.
Yeah, but I mean non-trivial.
Yes? Sure, it could be finite dimensional, even though we start with a separable one. It can't be bigger, because if I start with a space H of a certain cardinality and I take the span of those U to the KHs, this minimal dilation won't have cardinality any bigger than L of naught times the cardinality you started with. So if you started with an infinite-dimensional Hilbert space, the size of the Hilbert space doesn't get any bigger, but the dilation could be smaller. In particular, if I start with an isometry and take the unitary dilation, then when you, there's no reason to go up, only down. And if it was sort of one dimension short of being an isometry, you might just go up one dimension. It's easy enough to write such things down. Okay. So, the first important corollary is von Neumann's inequality. It says that if you have P norm at most 1 and P a polynomial, then the norm of P of P is less than the soup norm of P over the unit disk. Or it's the same thing because of the maximum modulus principle, the soup of the polynomial is over the unit circle. And the reason, the proof, is that if you take U a unitary dilation, okay, then the norm of P of T is less than or equal to the norm of P of U. Because if I take P of U, then I get P of T in the 2-2 entry. So clearly the norm of P of U is bigger than the norm of P of T. All right? But this is a unitary, so particularly it's a normal operator. So this is just the soup of P of Z, where Z runs over the spectrum of U. And, of course, the spectrum is contained in the unit circle. So this is less than or equal to P infinity. Okay. All right. Now, as you might imagine, that's being credited to von Neumann, not to Nash. Von Neumann proved it first by a different method. And you have to know more function theory, but you know, if you took a Möbius map from the circle onto the circle, you can do a direct calculation to see that if you evaluate such a Möbius map at an operator of norm 1, you still have an operator of norm 1. And then you can take finite products of those things and you get Blaschke products of an operator. And then if you know that the convex hull inside C of T of those Blaschke products is a set of all continuous functions which are analytic on the interior of the disk, then you would be able to prove it, okay? Another, a corollary of the corollary, right, is that if T is less than or equal to 1, then this representation, rho of P equals P of T, extends to a continuous, a contractive, in fact, representation of the disk algebra. So the disk algebra is the set of all functions f, which are f of z, which are analytic on the open disk and continuous on the closed disk. Okay. It's the closure of the polynomials. If you take the set of all polynomials and you close this up in the norm of continuous functions on the closed disk, but it's also the set of all polynomials closed up in the norm continuous functions on the circle, again by the maximum modulus principle. Okay. So what von Neumann's inequality exactly says is that you have that the norm of rho of p is less than or equal to the norm of p infinity, so therefore you can take limits. Okay. And this gives us the sense in which a unitary dilation is a representation, a dilation, star dilation of an operator algebra representation, right? So you have this representation of A of D, and if U is a unitary dilation, then this sigma of F equals F of U is a C of T dilation of rho. Okay? So we have the two forms back. Okay. Now, when Nag and Foyash started studying these things, I mean, or first Nag and then Nag and Foyash, one of the important things is that this gives you a nice functional calculus. If you start with T that's completely non-unitary, has no subspace on which is invariant, on which the restriction is a unitary, then when you dilate it to an isometry, at least, it's that isometry has no unitary sum end. It is the direct sum of copies of the unilateral shift. It's something called the Wohl decomposition. We know how to take analytic functions of the unilateral shift. They're called analytic Tuplex operators. And you can do this not just for functions in the disk algebra, but in fact for any bounded analytic function on a disk, this whole much bigger algebra called H infinity. So for most contractions, this unitary dilation allows you to get a much more powerful functional calculus, this H-infinity functional calculus. And this, you know, starting in the 50s and going up through the 70s, was a really a major tool for studying single operators. Okay. But now we're sort of diverging and going more towards more general operator algebras, and this gets more into the work of Arvidsson.